just going to make sure that it's picking up my voice and your voice. Okay. Can you give me your name?
Yeah, I'm Sandy McLaughlin.
Today's Monday, January the 21st. My name's Isabel Tuning, and I'm at the home of Sandy McLaughlin to do an interview with him for the Brownsburg Museum. Sandy's family, the McLaughlin family, has a long history in the Brownsburg area, and two of the areas I specifically are interested in talking about are the Camp Briar Hills and Sandy's grandfather, Dr. Henry McLaughlin. First, though, Sandy, could you give me a little background about yourself, your full name?
I'm Samuel Brown McLaughlin, Jr. I was born in Charlottesville, 1943. My father was teaching at Woodbury Forest School then, and he was from Rockbridge County. His father, Henry McLaughlin, was pastor here at New Providence, so he was born in the manse for New Providence. And was when I was born, was teaching school at Woodbury Forest, a boys' preparatory school near Orange, Virginia. And he, at that time, was coming to Rockbridge County each summer to direct Camp Briar Hills, which he did from the early 30s all the way up into the early 60s. He farmed here in Rockbridge County from 1949, ran his farm all the way through, I think it was sold in the early 70s. And Briar Hills was located over originally over near Brownsburg and then moved over here into the Pisgah area to Briarwood Farm around 1960 or so.
And so you were born in Charlottesville?
Born in Charlottesville.
Where did you primarily grow up?
I grew up ages 1 through 6 in Charlottesville, and then some of my most treasured years were here in Rockbridge County from age 6 till I was 12 when we moved back to Woodbury and he returned to teaching. He kept the farm during those years, but returned to teaching. And so my real growing up years, my formative years, really were here. My summers were always here with Camp Briar Hills. I went on to a career in science and worked at Oak Ridge National Laboratory and retired back here to Rockbridge County in 2004.
Did you actually go to school in Brownsburg when you were here?
I went to Brownsburg Elementary School from first grade through the fifth grade. In fact, we just had a reunion of our classmates last Friday night, which was interesting.
And who were your teachers when you were here? Do you remember your
teachers?
Yeah,
Ms. Lib Ward was my first grade teacher. Mrs. Whipple, Molly Sue Whipple, was my second grade teacher. Ms. Williams was the third grade. Ms. Lowe, the fourth grade. And Ms. Buchanan was the fifth grade teacher.
I had four of those five.
Did
in
you really?
Those grades, right? I had a different third grade teacher.
Yeah.
That's interesting, though.
Yeah, and it was the old school up on the hill there at Brownsburg. We had a total of maybe less than 300 grades 1 through 12 in the whole school, but it was an interesting and special time.
Could we back up a little and talk just a little bit about your grandfather and his time here in Brownsburg?
Yeah, Henry McLaughlin, we knew him as Big Papa, was a farm boy, grew up in West Virginia over near Lewisburg on a farm known as Max Welton, and became a Presbyterian minister. He came here to New Providence in 1909, was very active and very innovative in setting up a lot of programs here. He helped to establish Bank of Rockbridge with Mr. Whipple. He had a ministry at Pisgah Chapel and preached around in other places other than just at New Providence. The membership really expanded dramatically under his leadership. He formed cooperatives to help farmers organize their finances, and he was a farmer himself. He maintained leadership and ownership of Max Welton Farm in West Virginia, and they produced at least one world champion shorthorn cow, and sheep, was very much into sheep. So he had a nice background, a farming background, and was continuing to be a farmer, which helped him a lot in his ministry. He, because of the success he had in building this rural ministry here in Rockbridge, he was ultimately in 1921 appointed to become the first head of rural ministries for the Presbyterian Church of the, I guess it was of the U.S. at that time. And he moved to Richmond and was active with Union Theological Seminary teaching and administering this program in rural ministries, which was designed to help new pastors sort of equilibrate to expectations in a farming environment, to know what to expect, to know how to reach farming families and to build farming communities from a religious perspective.
Where had he gone to seminary?
He went to Union Theological Seminary himself, as I recall. He had 1 year, he went to the Near East, Mideast, to Palestine, which was a formative year in his life. And he was had a doctorate of divinity. He was Dr. McLaughlin, and was very well known as a very eloquent speaker and very dynamic leader. And it was in that capacity that he operated within the Presbyterian Church to build rural ministries across the country.
And it was quite a large family, right?
There were six brothers and three sisters in the McLaughlin family. And most of those, I think the younger, two-thirds anyway, were born in the manse there at New Providence.
Of which your father was born.
Including my father, mm-hmm. Sam McLaughlin, yes. And his wife, Nell Swan Brown, who became Nell Swan McLaughlin, was a direct descendant of Mary Moore, a captive of Abbs Valley, who was captured by the Shawnee back in 1786. And there's a story, a book written about captives of Abbs Valley that recounts the history of her family back then. Her great-great-grandfather was born in Rockbridge County, James Moore, and went to Abbs Valley to settle and raise horses, where he was on the very frontier, and he was ultimately killed by a raid of Shawnees back in 1786, and she was taken captive up into the Ohio River settlements, and her brother, James Moore, recovered her about 4 years later. She was 10 when she was taken captive, and I think she was 14 when she came back. So this was my grandmother's great-grandmother.
And so how did Dr. McLaughlin meet Nell?
He met her in West Virginia. He was doing some, the Brown family was out in Lewisburg, and I think he was active out there in the church. There was a ministry in Lewisburg. There was actually a college there, and he met her out in that area. Of course, his farm was in Lewisburg, which was nearby, right outside Lewisburg, in a little area called Maxwellton.
And is Maxwellton the name of the town or the name of the farm?
It's sort of a crossroads there. They actually named, I think he named the farm Maxwellton, and there's a little, maybe there was a post office there recently when I was back there. But that farm was Maxwellton Farm. Their original farm had been in Marlington, and his grandfather, Squire Hugh McLaughlin, had built a house there and a log home there in 1849, and eventually the railroad bought that property from him, and the town of Marlington was formed there. And he took the proceeds and went further down the valley towards Lewisburg and bought this farm on the Greenbrier River, which was quite a nice cattle and sheep farm.
And do you have personal recollections of your grandparents?
Oh yeah, very definitely of Big Pop and Big Mama. Big Papa was pretty close to retirement when I was born, I guess. He used to take me fishing down in Hayes Creek as a little boy. He loved to fish, and he would spend at least parts of his summers at Camp Briar Hills, which my father was running then, and my grandmother, Big Mama, was helping to run the camp and to do the meal planning and supervising the kitchen work. So I have very vivid memories of her. She was a sweet lady and loved to bird watch and pick berries and had a strong naturalist tendency. My father ended up being a biology teacher, so that was well played out in his career and his profession.
And when did they die?
My grandfather died in 1950. My grandmother died around early 1960s, I think it was.
And are they buried
In New Providence.
Are they buried at New Providence?
Yeah, as are Samuel Brown, after whom I'm named, and Mary Moore, who was his wife. Mary Moore came back from captivity, and Samuel Brown, who was one of the early pastors of New Providence, married her around early 1800s, and he had a ministry here as well. His home that he was building when he died was the home now owned by the Moneymakers, right on Hayes Creek Road.
Bellevue. And how did he die?
He was working harder than he should have been. He was actually working on building that house, and apparently he must have had a heart attack from the description of his final moments. It sounded like that's what it was.
And then did she go on and have the house finished, or?
Presumably so. I don't know the actual history. That was early 1800s, but it was finished, yeah.
And do you know if she ever lived there?
I presume that she did. I think he was sort of in the later stages of construction at the time that he died, but I don't have a strong knowledge base on that history.
Well, thank you so much for the background on Dr. McLaughlin and family. I particularly wanted to get from you some information about Camp Briar Hills. Could you tell me a little of the background about how it started?
Yeah, Briar Hills was located up on the hills overlooking Brownsburg, looking out to the beautiful view of Jump Mountain, and it was about a 40 to 50 acre parcel of land that my father's sister, Margaret McLaughlin Hogsett, ultimately she married Fulton Hogsett of Augusta County, ran for her children. It was sort of a summer recreational camp. She had two daughters, Nell and Carafan, and a son, Dickie, and they and some of their friends would come there in the summer, and they had sort of a, I'm not sure how it was organized, but it was a group of visiting friends and whatnot, so it was sort of a co-ed summer country adventure for some young people during the summer months.
And were they primarily children who grew up in the city?
They grew up in, presumably they grew up in Augusta County, and I'm not sure, I somehow have the impression that some of the visitors that came were from Richmond and places like that. But the Hogsett Farm was off of Brownsburg-Middlebrook Turnpike. Margaret died in the around 1930, as near as I can recall, and the very first pictures that we have of an actual camp, it became an all-male camp, and my father is pictured with his mother and his brother Henry McLaughlin with an all-male camp with about, I think there were maybe 14 young men, boys basically. They look like they're from age anywhere from 6 to maybe 12 there in 1932, and Daddy became ultimately the director. He was just 21 years old, or 20 actually, in that picture. It was taken, well, midsummer, he could have been 21. And he began directing it, I know, full time when he graduated from college, which is around that, he graduated from Hampton City around 1935. So presumably he and his brothers ran it with his mother in the very first couple of years, and then Daddy took it over. And his brother Lee, his younger brother, only younger brother, when he came back from, he was a captain in the Navy in World War II, came back and they co-directed Briar Hills. And it grew very, very nicely and began to be bigger than they felt comfortable with. The emphasis was on rustic sort of character building. The activities were riding and archery and badminton, shop, athletics. There were six total activities, riflery, and the boys would do three of one activity one day and three the next, and they were divided into groups with Indian names, the Sioux, the Navajo, the Comanche, the Mohawks, Cherokee, and the Apache, as I recall. There were six groups. And there were typically anywhere from 50 to 65 campers in the camp, and they began to have so many more applicants than they could take that they decided in 1948, the next year, they divided into a more senior camp with the older boys up through early teens and the young being now members of Camp Max Walton, which was under Uncle Lee's direction. And they initially held that camp. The camp site was over here near Pisgah, just below where we're talking right now on what was my father's farm, Briarwood Farm. A lake was built and some cabins were built to allow this half of the camp to move over there in 1949. And Lee and Max Walton has run ever since. It's now in the direction of Lee Jr. and Lee Massey McLaughlin. And so Max Walton ran at Briarwood Farm, just below where we're seated right now, for 3 or 4 years, and then Uncle Lee bought his own place with Aunt Rosa over at the foot of Chum Mountain, and they called that Max Walton Farm, Max Walton Camp, and it's run there ever since. Briar Hills, in the meantime, continued at its Brownsburg site until the very early 60s, and Daddy moved it over because we had facilities, we had a lake, and we had cabins that were permanent cabins. A lot of the sleeping that was done at the old Briar Hills was on wooden platforms and military tents, about five campers and a counselor per tent. And the boys that weren't in tents were in sleeping porches, which were metal roof screened porch is very delightful, wonderful place to sleep during a rainstorm with awnings that roll down in, you know, when you had blowing rain and whatnot. And so a very character-oriented camp Daddy did initially, and Lee does, and young Lee still does, lead a devotion every morning. The day started off seated on the porch and with some biblical lesson and some character development derivative from that related to life as boys would see it at this time, life that would help build their character. I remember one particularly poignant morning. I was occasionally spoiled enough to be able to go with my father when he was running the camp at Briar Hills and had the farm over at Briarwood Farm. He still had some farm chores to do, and he would get up very early in the morning, 5 o'clock. And very occasionally he would let me ride over with him, which was always a thrill. And we'd be back in time for breakfast at 8 o'clock, but it was just nice to be with your dad and have him to yourself as a young boy, because at camp he was, of course, Sam. He was the leader and he was, you know, a dominant figure. But that particular morning we walked around the lake and he pulled out some, he was a biologist, he pulled up some frogs. Tadpoles and frogs in various stages of development and put them in a bucket. And that morning our devotion dealt with different people being at different stages of development as they are building their characters to become who they will become. And the tadpoles, lo and behold, were part of the morning devotion. So that was very special. But Daddy was a biologist, and like all the McLaughlin children, they had a very strong sense of the natural world. And I think the natural world was just one more awe-inspiring component of their religious framework, and he never ceased to be impressed and impress others with his understanding of biology and the significance of living things and their relationship to the Creator. So he was a very natural teacher, and those morning devotions were probably not more than 15 minutes, but it was each day some new aspect of character development that was particularly meaningful for young boys at that stage, and he was able to target his age range of campers very well. So the mornings were filled with these events, the six events that I mentioned, three each day. Afternoons were, it was always a rest hour in the middle of the day, and then you would have athletics and swimming, softball and swimming, and they would alternate. One half the camp would do one first, the other half would do the other. Our swimming hole was Hayes Creek. It was dammed up with sandbags, and it had to be built back typically at least once during the summer because there'd be a heavy rainfall and flood event that would come through, and that was all part of the character building aspect of being in Briar Hills. You fashioned your own swimming hole and you maintained it. You took blocks of wood and sanded them and made them into lamps and things like that rather than have some easy kit-type thing that was razzle-dazzle. The kids learned to work with wood and make paddle boats or anything they could take home as an example of their learned skills. Special events during the summer were trip up Jump Mountain was always something greatly to be looked for. When you got to be perhaps as old as 10, you would be able to go up, jump and with the campers and spend a night over there. When other trips that we took in the valley, of course, we had the Lexington, the museum at BMI, and W&L, the Lee Chapel, and some of the caverns, Grand Caverns, Luray Caverns, and so we would those would be interspersed during the six-week summer session for special events, outings, and whatnot. So Briar Hills ran at the campsite above Brownsburg all the way to, as I say, around 1960, 61, so forth, and then it moved over here. And my brother-in-law, George McVeigh, Daddy retired from directing the camp around 1963 or so, and my brother-in-law ran it for, I think, 3 years through 1966, 67, somewhere in that range. And it stopped at that point. George became headmaster at St. Christopher's, and he needed to be at Richmond, at the Richmond campus year-round. And I had become a professional scientist and biologist, environmental scientist, and was not able to take summers off from my work to direct the camp. But Max Welton has carried on the tradition and still runs today as both an all-boys camp and with Camp Lachlan having been started, golly, I guess it must have been started 20 years ago as an all-girls camp that followed the boys camp. And that's at that Max Welton site right at the base of Jump Mountain, which is an ideal location on Hayes Creek for a camp. And of course, there's a lake for swimming and cabins. Everybody sleeps in cabins up on the hill there. So that's a nice permanent sleeping arrangement that's very dependable. Tents occasionally leaked, tents occasionally had to be repaired, and platforms had to be repaired, but it was all a very nice and beautiful environment. And one of the most poignant memories was at the end of camp each year, and I should say, Briar Hills emphasized improvement as much as doing well. So when the boys completed their morning activities at lunch every day, the camp counselors who led a particular event, whether it be riflery or archery or whatnot, would say, okay, in the Cherokees today, the best was so-and-so and the most improved was so-and-so. So everybody got recognized for improvement with equal weight as being the best. And of course, the boys were put in groups that were of comparable ability so that they could compete and were a similar stage of development. And at the end of the year, the final closing ceremonies, awards were given out, and the best award was the same as the most improved award. They were all identical, and all received with great pride. And the closing ceremony was always capped off by singing In the Valley of Virginia, high up on a hill, where our hopes are realized and our dreams fulfilled. She is the best of all the rest, her spirit you cannot kill. Hail to thee, we sing this song, dear old Camp Briar Hills. And typically the sun was setting or getting close to it on Jump, and it was just a very meaningful song, very meaningful camp for many, many young men for decades.
Could you tell me a little bit about the buildings? Did your family build the main buildings that were there at the camp?
I'm not certain that there weren't some buildings there before Aunt Margaret had it. I really don't know the history of those buildings. I know that some of them for sure were built. There were probably a couple of log cabins there that were added onto with the sleeping porches. I began camp there in 1947, and it had been running for 1948. I was 5 years old then, so it had been running for 15 years. Roughly by the time that I went, but the center of the camp was a complex that had a kitchen, a big dining hall that was screened in, and above the dining hall was a sleeping porch that held double rooms that held perhaps 15 to 20 young campers between the two of them, then another wing that held another perhaps 10. Then there was a separate log cabin, the east building that had a story, sort of a general activities room, a downstairs sleeping area, and then another screen porch up top. Of course, all covered metal roof and wood up to about belt high, and the upper portion would have been where windows would normally be, was screened with awnings that rolled down. And about half of the camp, when the camp got to its full size of perhaps maximum, maybe 75 or so, about half of the older campers slept in tents, which were military tents. I'm guessing they were probably 15, 20 feet by 20 feet, and they were erected on wooden platforms. And the boys slept on cots that were obtained from VMI, graduating cadets, military cots. They had an inspection every morning to make sure they had made up their beds and tidied up everything, and they got awards for having particularly neat beds and neat quarters. And those tents were really very pleasant to sleep in. The sides could be let up or down, and at night, on normal nights, they were up, and you have a wonderful, it's like sleeping out of doors, but you had something over top of you. So a very nice sleeping environment.
And they were named?
Oh, they were all named after Confederate generals. Longstreet, Jackson, and so forth. There were as many as A.P. Hill. There were as many as six tents at one time, maybe seven, but all named after Confederate generals.
And then the tents were taken down after the end of the season?
They were taken down at the end of the season and stored away. And so just the wooden platform would be there over the way.
And then latrines? Was there a shower facility? Or
there, no, we took, everybody swam every day in Hayes Creek. We took a skinny dip on Sunday mornings before going to church, and that water was really cold in the morning, even in the summer. So everybody took a classical soap bath and soaked up, and had to be inspected as being soaked up in Hayes Creek on Sunday morning. But the Johnny houses were wooden, two and three seaters, so they were the classic outdoor commode. The only plumbing for purposes of hygiene was there was an area where the boys kept their toothbrushes and soap and whatnot, and they had to be inspected after breakfast and supper before they went to bed to have brushed their teeth. They had to show their gums and show their teeth, make sure they had cleaned themselves and properly taken care of dental hygiene. So there was a covered area with spigots, and people had cups and basins that were assigned to them by number. And so they did their wash up and toothbrushing at that running water facility. But the main facility basically had just a kitchen with, of course, running water and whatnot. The water came from a spring down at Hayes Creek, and it was piped up into a cistern right up above the main area of the camp. We dug our own tennis courts out of the side of the hill. I think they used a mule and a wheelbarrow as a scoop to get that out, and of course built our own rifle range and archery range, were just bales of hay and whatnot that were set up with targets.
Where'd you find a place flat enough for softball?
There was a meadow down on the way, halfway down from Briar Hills down to Hayes Creek, and there was a meadow also. We had field days too, in which we did competition in track and field. The classical events, high jump races, long jumps, and things like that. And that was done down in the meadow beside Hayes Creek, as well as some events in the on the softball diamond. The softball diamond was perhaps 400 yards below the main campsite on the way down to the creek, and so it was very convenient to either swam first, as I indicated, or played softball first and then rotated. So they were sort of on the way as you went down towards the creek.
Did you have a big 4th of July celebration?
There was always a fireworks of some type. Typically, we'd have a group going up jump, so they would be up there with their flashlights signaling back to the campers on the hill there above Briar Hills. And yeah, we had fireworks every 4th of July up there on the big hill, looking at over Brownsburg, that was always a big treat, yeah.
Was there Parents' Day? Did these boys see their parents the whole...
There was a Visitor's Day halfway through the camp session, and they would come and they could take their sons out to a meal, Lexington or whatever, or go to Goshen with them or whatnot. It was typically an afternoon, and they were back by, certainly by bedtime. So it was just about a half a day midway through camp. And there was a typical letter writing. The boys had supervised letter writing sessions to make sure they corresponded with their parents back home. And so it was a special time. Daddy was very good at sort of gauging young boys. Some of these boys, it was really interesting. The ones that it had the most effect on were perhaps some from the inner city, being Richmond or Washington or whatever, that really had never done things for themselves. And so there was a tremendous sense of accomplishment in a young boy for the first time riding a horse or shooting a rifle or shooting a bow, just the sense that you could do that. And of course you were placed with a group of comparable abilities, so you were competing with boys of your age, but as I said, you got recognized for improvement as well as for being the very best at each one of those events. So it was a very strongly oriented camp towards character development. You know, fall down, get up, try again. Keep doing it until you get better at it and be happy to have improved. Even if you're not the very best at it, you know that you tried, that you kept at it. I can remember Daddy frequently talking about intestinal fortitude, guts, having the guts to, if you're Daniel in the lion's den, you had the guts to be dependent on the Lord for your protection, or if you're whatever. Plenty of examples from life of folks that that gutted it out and were able to succeed. And I think Briarhills campers went away with a good sense of self-worth and a good sense of what they were capable of doing, and either as provided by physical or mental capacity, or the capacity to improve by working at something.
You mentioned that did they call him Sam?
Yes, they did. Yeah, he was called Sam. And of course, I couldn't call him Sam. But it was a little strange for me. I had, of course, I worshipped him. He was, he was sort of the hero as camp director. He, he was a really smart guy, and he had the right answers for most questions in most situations. But he was referred to as Sam by campers and counselors alike. And so for me, he was sort of borrowed. He was the property of all the boys. I couldn't have other than the special situation of his allowing me to go over to the farm with him in the mornings occasionally. It wasn't a frequent thing. Maybe maximum of four times during the summer I would get to do that. That was the only privilege I got. I also got my poor little rear end worn out by him one time because I had more demerits, they call them black marks, than anybody else in camp. And I always felt like the counselors, maybe I was so much of a brat at that stage, but I seemed to be getting demerits very, very easily. And I sure enough got my belting, as he was wont to do, and just like anybody else would have. Also was once there was an altercation with another camper, and he had us, occasionally he would have him put on boxing gloves to settle a dispute if there was something that he thought needed to be settled in that way. So I was supervised in a boxing match at one time with another little boy who was particularly fractious, and we got that settled.
were there local counselors and campers?
There were a few local counselors, and I know Fred Whipple went as a camper. He was never a counselor, I think. Bruce Alexander, who I think now is a medical doctor from over near Fairfield, was there as a counselor for a year or two. Donnie Swope, the son of Carl Swope, who ran the general store in Brownsburg, was there as a counselor. But not a whole lot of local boys, just a smattering.
Any famous alums?
Yeah, I think one of our alums became governor of West Virginia, Gordon Caperton, Austin Caperton. George East was our only loss in World War II. He was a counselor there, and he was on a destroyer that was sunk by a torpedo. And so we had the East Room, and I still have a drum that George East made, an Indian drum that's about the size of a good-sized nail keg with rawhide tongs and rawhide drum surfaces that he made and painted, and that was always part of the ritual that we had story hours every night, and we had counselors were responsible for telling stories before we went to bed. There would be some supper or some activity, Andy over or some game that would be played, and then we'd have story hour and then go to bed and taps. And so the East Room was the place where typically we had story hour, and George East drum was in that building. And when it rained, we'd have skits. We'd do some kind of plays of some silly type that was, you know, that kept times occupied, or play games or things like this. Yeah, that's the one thing you really hope doesn't happen, is to have extended rainy days when you've got 50 or 60 young kids full of energy and wanting to be out and doing things. So, but we always managed to tough it out and do fine.
Any homesickness?
Oh yeah, there were always.
Parents have to come a lot.
Yeah, there were always a few. I don't think never more than a handful total over time that I'm aware of that couldn't stay. I think they always stayed. You know, they toughed it out. I don't remember anybody going homesick. They, you know, the idea is to get them feeling a part of a group. That's why they're in the Indian group together, and they go around with their friends of their age group. And so, you know, obviously you're going to have some homesickness, but they seem to do very well.
And how about the local folks who worked for your dad?
We had a really great group of African-American folks that worked in the kitchen with meal preparation. One individual, Bob Schultz, and his wife Bert were really a mainstay part of the camp, in the sense that he was sort of the general handyman, very physically able man, able to do most anything with hammer or axe or whatever, hard-working individual. Bert was the maitre d' of the kitchen and supervised the cooking. The meal planning was always done by my grandmother or my mother eventually. But there was Lucille Brown, and I think Betty Brown, who now works in the post office as a young girl, was there for at least one summer. And Dorothy Schultz was a really treasured part of the camp. So they were a real part and parcel of the camp spirit, and very fine additions to the staff.
When the camp moved out here to Pisgah, did your family sell the property at Briar Hills in
Williamsburg? No, they kept that for a time, and eventually I think Steve Heffelfinger bought it and ran some cattle on it. There was a nice log cabin was built actually above the old campsite up on the hill that's still there today, and I don't know Lucy's last name, but it's currently owned by someone from the Washington area, I think.
Rain. Lucy Rain, R-A-J-A-N-E.
Okay, yeah. So, you know, folks that go there, I was to a gathering there 2 years ago, and that magnificent view of Jump in the North Range is, of course, still there and still impressive.
Did your family move anything from that camp out here to Pisgah?
Some of the tents. We had three tents out here, of the sleeping tents. There were enough cabins. There were four cabins, each of which would sleep perhaps 15 campers or so. So we had the sleeping capacity with the permanent cabins, and made up the difference with tents when we needed to.
Was there a garden there?
There was always a garden. That was one of the things that Bert Schultz took care of. He would till it and take care of it, and occasionally some of the campers were involved in weeding it and whatnot. But we got corn and tomatoes and beans and whatnot from the garden, just as they do at Max Welton now. So yeah, there was a garden at both places. Of course, the horses went from the old camp to the new camp, and there were some colorful horses. Blaze was Daddy's. He was a very spirited horse, and only Daddy and one other camp riding instructor, Stuart Hopewell, really rode Blaze. He was a little much for just an average rider to handle, but he was a very impressive male horse. And there were other really well-dispositioned horses. One of them, Silver, was a white horse. I remember vividly one rainy day all day long, and just at the end of the, just before sunset, we thought maybe the sun had gone down, and the front came through and the sun came breaking out over Jump, and this like a golden beam shot out, and there was Silver standing up on the hill just shining in this golden beam. And the sky, this was a frontal system passing through, and it was the most brilliant sunset with all variety of blues and greens and pinks and yellows that evening, and Silver standing out there like some grand divine hand had reached down and painted him silver. It was really special. But yeah, Silver, Major, Tony were some of the horses' names. And when they rode, when we rode trails, which there were all around the old camp, and it was a follow the leader thing. You were in a line. You were not out riding individually, but you were following the lead rider, who was a counselor, and depending on which horse you got. And they were used to being in a particular arrangement, and they got upset if they were out of their arrangement. They had their place in the line, and so they were very comfortable with that.
How about the farm here at Briarwood? What kind of farming did your dad do here?
Dad predominantly raised cattle and sheep. There were some hogs on the farm when we got here. It's a wonderful old farm. It's the McChesney House. It was built in 1785. There it actually had been some slaves involved back when, and there were some of the slave quarters that burned down, I think, just about the year that we got there, or the year before. But it was about, when he bought it, I think 370 acres, rolling hills and valleys, and probably a fourth or less of that was woodland. He raised Black Angus cattle and Hampshire sheep predominantly, but the main operation was cattle for beef.
And so he would be teaching over in Orange County, but did he have a farm manager?
He had actually Jerry Swisher. It must have been Jerry Swisher's father that ran, he co-managed with Daddy. Jerry would feed the cattle during the winter. We typically had 100 head or so, something like that. And so, of course, when we lived here, Daddy ran the farm. When he went back to Woodbury, Jerry would look after the cattle, and they partnered in doing that. And now, Jerry Swisher, presumably his son, is managing the McElvain's farm and comes in routinely to look after the cattle there, so it's interesting.
And that's the owner now who lives?
Frank McElvain is the current owner. He's bought two farms adjoining the original farm. I think he's got over 1,000 acres now. And Jerry Swisher comes in and manages the cattle operation, apparently.
And that's our contemporary Jerry
Swisher,
right?
Yes, our contemporary, yeah.
I think that's all the notes I've made about the camp. Let me look through some of these other questions and see. When did your parents retire back here?
It was around 1970, I think it was. I guess it was actually late 60s. They were back here, around mid-60s, I think, they were back here. Daddy taught at Woodbury 1956 through
Mid to late 60s. Of course, the farm was maintained. They would come back here for summers, but then they came back and were at the farm for a couple of years in the early 70s, and then moved and sold the farm to Dick Glenn and moved into Lexington and lived there for a couple of years, and then they moved eventually to Powhatan near Richmond. Daddy was an avid golfer, was an excellent coach, coached golf and football and baseball and basketball at various times at Woodbury. Had an incredible winning percentage. I went back and looked through some of the records, and I think he won 80% of his matches, no matter what sport or his teams won 80% of the matches, no matter what sport he was in. Ultimately, he had really good teams. He was a great motivator. So, but golfing was one of his real loves, and he played that actively. He died in 1987, and he was 76 and shot his age twice, I think, during that year. So when he went back, he was active with the Lexington Golf Club. I think he was in some sort of maybe advisory capacity relative to the course. But when he went back to Powhatan, initially, he helped with a golf course that was built around a lake situation there where he lived next to some dear friends of his and my mother's, the Odens, on the lake there at Powhatan. And so the golf course was right there, which was very convenient for him.
Was your mother a local person?
My mother was born Nancy Harrison, and she was from Petersburg. And so she was a city girl. So when they came up here in 1949, it was a sort of a rude awakening for her. But she was a character type and a strong character. And she did well under that circumstance.
Now, was your dad part of the crowd in Brownsburg that would go into the stores and loaf and tell stories and
practical jokes? He would do that, yeah. I know of one story that I was told regarding his being in the store there. I think there was someone who was a professional entomologist who taught biology and insects and whatnot, and Daddy was in the store with probably Doug Whipple, I think, or somebody like that. And he was talking about a particular bug that they were studying, and they were trying to determine what it was eating, and there was a real mystery involved with it, and they didn't know how it processed its food somehow. And he tantalized, knowing this guy was an entomologist, he told just enough to get this guy interested, got him to ask, well, how did they actually determine what was going on inside the abdomen of this insect that was some predatory insect? And Daddy, with a straight face, said, well, they put a little glass window in there, and they put a windshield wiper, and it would sweep back and forth, and they could look in there and see. And, of course, the guy knew he was being jacked with. Another thing that happened that was sort of interesting with my father, and this was with Doug Whipple. Daddy wore a pistol when he was out walking around checking the cattle and whatnot. You know, he would shoot groundhogs or foxes or whatever. And he and Doug Whipple had a great relationship, sort of a kidding. They were classmates together when they were boys growing up. And Doug was kidding, well, what are you wearing that pistol for? And Daddy said, well, you know, occasionally I want to shoot squirrels and things out of the top of trees, and I typically just shoot their left eyes out when I do that. And they were walking along, and lo and behold, there was a squirrel up in the tree, and Daddy pulled out his pistol and shot the squirrel, and it fell out, and his left eye was out. So, fairly amazing, fortuitous situation by strictest and wildest luck, but that's what happened.
Do you remember any of the Brownsburg characters when you were growing up?
No particular characters. I mean, there was the usual group, you know, in the store. Daddy's friends were, you know, that he kidded around a lot with were the Whipples. The character out here in Pisgah who was really special was George Lotz, who was a shade tree mechanic with incredible instincts for fixing things, just an old country fellow who had tremendous insight into how things worked and had a garage and shop down here just below where we're sitting right now, and was a great coon hunter and drove a Model T around the roads here. Had his two coon hounds, Rattler and Brownie, and they were typically sitting up in the seat beside him and looked like three people going down the road. J- George is a great big old moon-faced guy with chewed tobacco, and normally there was a stain coming down one side of his mouth or the other, and wore bib overalls and played a fiddle and was just a wonderful country character. And his mother, Sarah Liz, Sweet, lived in the little house that you drove by on the way to my house where we're sitting, which is an historical cabin that her, I'm sure there's her mother or grandmother lived in, who was a post-Civil War person. The father came back from the Civil War injured and made shoes, apparently, and lived in that house. It was built in the late 1860s or so. So, George and Lizzie Lotz were wonderful and treasured assets and components of this Pisgah community for years and years.
Any other stories or reminiscences from Brownsburg that you'd like to share with us? I've gotten through my questions.
I think there's an innate sense of self-sufficiency that derives from growing up in the country and the feeling of being a part of that rural community, where the boys were proud of what they could do, what they had developed to the stage where whether it was driving a tractor or this, that, or the other, whatever the metrics of being a successful, growing young country person who was able to, to make do and be resourceful. That was a special feeling that I came away from this community with. Whether it was justified or not, I always felt like I had an edge over the city boys who hadn't done all these things and didn't have that savvy and sort of innate resourcefulness that comes with growing up in the country. Of course, we rode the school bus. I can remember walking occasionally in the snow home, once just about knee deep, because the cars couldn't get out to get us. I guess we got caught at school with the big snow. But anyway, it was a special time growing up.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your camp memories.
You're certainly
Dr. McLaughlin memories.
Pleased to be able to do so.